Greetings. This is Steve Malanga, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, one of the contributors to our website, Public Sector Inc. And I'm here with Christian Snyder, who is a senior fellow at the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. And we're talking about Christian's latest piece, which has been posted on the Public Sector Inc. website. Greetings, Christian.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. One of the things that I find most interesting about your piece is that in the very top of the piece, you talk a little bit about the process by which collective bargaining, which has become such a lightning rod issue in Wisconsin, first came to the state in 1959. It's often said that Wisconsin was the first state to get collective bargaining for public sector workers. Of course, it was federal legislation that enabled private sector workers to have collective bargaining back in the 1930s. But one of the things you point out is that there was a very political nature to the deal in 1959. Could you describe that a little bit?
Public sector unionization in Wisconsin dates all the way back into the mid-40s, where AFSCME was actually founded right here in Madison, Wisconsin. But it didn't become law until 1959, which, you know, people are critical of Scott Walker right now, saying his efforts to get rid of public sector collective bargaining, or at least limit it, is a giveaway to his big wealthy campaign contributors. But back in 1959, when Governor Gaylord Nelson first implemented collective bargaining for public employees, it kind of had the look of a political giveaway itself. In the early 1950s, the Democratic Party was almost a dead party in Wisconsin. Progressives were still primarily in the Republican Party. Democrats hadn't had had one governor in about 83 years. So the party was actually really on life support, and it was a lot of union money that really pumped life into the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. In 1954, when Bill Proxmire ran for governor, about 55% of the money that he raised was from the unions. Union money was so prevalent in Democratic politics at the time that the Republicans actually tried to pass a law banning union money from being used in campaigns. So in 1958, the Democratic resurgence was almost complete. Governor Gaylord Nelson took over, and one of the first things that he did was implement this change to allow public sector collective bargaining. At the time, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin was running at about a $10,000 deficit at the time he took office, and about 5 years later, they were running about a $50,000 surplus. So it looked a lot like kind of a political giveaway to the public sector unions at the time.
Now, one of the things you say in your piece is that supporters of Governor Walker have pointed out that all he wanted was the same powers that President Obama enjoys over the federal workforce. Could you expand on that a little bit? What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, that's something that actually came to my attention on my podcast that we had with you. You know, Governor Walker is trying to scale back collective bargaining on pretty much everything except salary, yet nobody's out protesting, banging a drum into the White House, because federal employees, while they have unions, they have very limited ability, and in most cases, no ability to bargain on salary and benefits. So even if Scott Walker's plan were to pass, which it already has, and we expect it to become law soon despite the court challenges, they would still have more ability to collectively bargain on wages than most federal employees would have.
Now, one of the things that's happened, you mentioned you expect the legislation to become law. It has not yet. It's being held up by court challenges. Also, in the aftermath, both sides in this debate have threatened, I guess if that's the right word, recall petitions for those who either voted against or rather voted for rescinding collective bargaining, that is, voted for the governor's proposals, or those who opposed them and Democrats who left the state. Could you sort of catch us up on where the recall movement is and how recall actually works in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, in order to recall a state senator or a governor, as they're going to try to do for Scott Walker, you have to be in office for a full year. So all the people that were just elected in November aren't eligible for recall for a full year. But there are some that are already in office that voted for the bill that are going to be subject to a recall coming up here pretty soon. What you have to do to trigger a recall is collect 25% of the signatures of the voters in the last gubernatorial election. So that amounts in most state Senate districts to about 15,000 to 17,000 votes. I believe you have 30 days to do so, to collect the signatures, and then another 30-day review process for all those signatures to be verified. So it's been used extremely rarely in Wisconsin. If they were to recall more than one senator, it would be unprecedented in the state's history. But again, we're also in a time where social networking is really playing a part in a lot of the demonstrations that we've seen here in the state. When they passed the bill, I think 2 hours notice was given, and a site went up on Facebook, and the call went out on Twitter. And within 2 hours, I think they had, you know, 6,000-7,000 people down here rushing the Capitol just on that short notice. So we're kind of in a different time here with social networking, so it's kind of hard to figure out how this is all going to go. Now, I know Republicans have said that they plan on recalling some of the, or at least attempting to recall some of the senators that fled to Illinois. But, you know, in a lot of cases where you have union support trying to recall Republicans, that's going to be a lot more organized and a lot better chance of that happening.
Well, that's interesting. Let's explore that for a moment, because there were some counter demonstrations by groups identified as, let's say, Tea Party groups. And I'm wondering if you could tell us the extent of the influence of the Tea Party in Wisconsin or of other taxpayer-like groups as a counterbalance or not to public sector unions. Could talk a little bit about that.
I was actually down at the demonstrations the first day that the Tea Party announced that they were going to have a presence there. And it was really interesting to see, just walking around the Capitol Square, you know, I think that day they counted about 80,000 people were down just on the Capitol Square that day. And I went and I walked around kind of the Tea Party people, and kind of right at the crux where the Tea Party people were going to meet the public union people, just to kind of see what happened. And it was very peaceful. You know, there was a lot of yelling back and forth, no violence or anything. But while the Tea Party people were there, and I think they were actually pretty fairly brave for being there, they were certainly a lot smaller in number than the pro-union folks. There were, of the 80,000 people maybe that were there, I would say maybe 5,000 were Tea Partiers. And I think it obviously comes down to, you have a few people who are extremely interested in this legislation because it affects them personally. We have all the students and all the state employees that are heavily affected by this legislation, whereas you have a very disparate kind of group out there that are only slightly affected by it, and so therefore, you know, they just don't really have the incentive to come down and rally on a day where it's 15 degrees outside.
Right. Well, it's pretty clear then that even though international events have, if you will, kicked Wisconsin off the front pages in the past week or so, that this is really an ongoing story, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more from Christian on this. This is Steve Malanga with the Manhattan Institute. To read Christian's story or more about the issue of public sector unions in America, you can go to www.publicsectorinc.org. Thank you.